This is Where We Live.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
I, sitting my desk, certainly have the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
While the Supreme Court did not give marriage equality advocates everything they wanted, the court gave them more than half.
What kind of world will we live in if the United States of America sees a dictator brazenly violate international law with poison gas, and we choose to look the other way?
I think that this conflict could spiral out of control and drag the United States into something that is much beyond just one targeted missile strike.
They appreciate it. The $20,000. I got another $10,000 to get to Josh tonight for killing the bill.
And if you're bashful, I got a snake sitting under my desk here.
Sometimes Mother Nature deals a card that is not in your deck. And that is what we experienced.
This is our city.
It's not like it's a Super Bowl, right, Jerome?
How could that happen at the Super Bowl, huh? Well, that would make it memorable, huh?
Are they just showing mad Super Bowl commercials right now, or what?
I ate cat vomit right here on television.
Yeah, just a snippet of some of what happened in 2013. I'm John Dankosky. We're going to look back at 2013 in the news and talk about what it means. Looking ahead at 2014, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable on WNPR. Our final wheelhouse of the year, so we've brought in an all-star panel today, and we want to hear from you. What were your biggest stories of 2013? What are your predictions for 2014? You can call us at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can always email us where we live at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live, and you can follow along at WNPR.org. So I want to welcome in Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, as always. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hi, Christine.
Good morning, John.
Bill Curry is our political analyst, former Democratic nominee for governor. Hello, Bill.
Morning, sir. Nice to be here.
And Kalila Brown-Dean joins us, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. So glad to see you in person, Kalila.
It's great to see you, too.
So what I want to do is I want to start with our panelists and really talk through what they think the biggest stories are of the year. I'm sure we'll get some phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's start with you, Colin. For you, looking back at 2013, those things in our snippets, just a few of the stories. There's a lot more that we haven't talked about there and that we will throughout the course of this hour. What's the big news story for you this year?
Well, I was going to say Scott Haney eating cat vomit. That was in there. Either that or Ernest Hewitt making it the year of the snake. But no, here in Connecticut, for me, the biggest story, I'm not saying it is the biggest story, but I think in a lot of ways it's a story with profound and lasting implications, is the assault on transparency here in Connecticut. You know, we have this sort of landmark FOI law, you know, the first one of its kind in the nation. And really, over the course of the year, we've just seen a constant battering of it, not merely tied to the Newtown records, which were sort of turned into a three-part assault on freedom of information. But even before that, the Malloy administration made its second attempt to kneecap the watchdog agencies, including the Freedom of Information Commission. I think it also shows up in just the way business was done. Once again, that sort of lack of transparency. So you've got something like Keno being added to the state budget with no public hearing, no nothing, dead of night. Even the people who follow these issues don't know it's happening. Kevin Rennie kind of caught the Malloy administration doing a lot of its public business on private email accounts. Once again, assault on transparency. And finally, we have this commission that never should have been convened in the first place, and whose composition and whose attitude towards its mission pretty much guaranteed some kind of weakening of our freedom of information law. We weren't going to come out of this commission with the same FOI law that we went in with. And in fact, within the last day or so, they've made their recommendations, and that's exactly what's happened.
So, Christine, moving forward, with something like this issue, so often when we see a year filled with stories about anything, the next legislative session, there is some movement, at least among some quarter of legislators, that will say, we need to do something about it. We need to strengthen this or weaken that. From who you talk to at the Capitol, are there lawmakers who are concerned about what Colin just said?
You know, I would hope that there are lawmakers concerned about what Colin said.
There was a lot of tension this year, all year, between the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. And so the Second Amendment consumed most of February, March, well, actually January, February, March, April, until they passed tightening of the gun legislation restrictions in the state. And now if you do not register your assault weapon before January 1st, you could be convicted of a felony if you're caught with it and it's not registered. So there's been this tension all year between the, you know, those two rights.
Well, and that's the story that you wanted to talk about, the fact that we spent the first part of this year talking an awful lot about guns, and then it seems both from the state level and from the national level, Christine, we just kind of stopped.
Yeah. I mean, every 3 months now, people from Newtown, people from Connecticut are going to the Capitol in Washington, and they're lobbying legislators to pass some sort of restriction, bring back the, you know, the Brady Bill. But it's not... there hasn't been an event. You would think that Newtown, the Navy Yard shooting, some of these other incidents that have happened this year would force Congress to do something, and there just isn't enough there.
We'll talk maybe a bit later on about whether or not this state or the federal government might do anything more about guns coming up in 2014. Bill, for you, what's the big story of 2013?
I'm going to just copy Colin on this and say that it's transparency to a large degree, but just shift the focus to the federal government and to Snowden and to the case this last week, Judge Richard Leon finding the entire NSA operation unconstitutional, and I would just point out a couple of things, and this is a disappointment with President Obama, akin to that with Governor Malloy. But the president ran on very clearly and strongly on making government more transparent to us and protecting the right to privacy, and it's the opposite. Government is less transparent to us, and we're more transparent to it. And that's not, I think, what people are looking for. But the bottom line here, one, about Snowden, he did something wrong, and like everybody did something wrong, he should have to pay some kind of penalty for it. But as I used to say, there ought to be something called obstruction of injustice, for which you still pay a penalty, but a much smaller one. Everything that is on the table here has been found to be unconstitutional on the domestic front. And we've discovered something about ourselves, that our government operates terribly when it operates in secret. And whether that's at the state level or in terms of our foreign policy, everybody in the world still thinks that the Middle East is angry at us because they hate us for our freedom, as George Bush said. Most Americans don't know how many governments we toppled there and haven't had put in front of them the idea that there are choices to make. When our government operates in public, by and large, to a really reassuring degree, it upholds our highest ideals of our country. And when it operates in secret, it almost never does.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Colin, about this, and maybe the difference between federal transparency and transparency at the state level, is the things that you were talking about, whether or not it had to do with the Malloy administration or lawmakers, it had to do with government essentially setting new boundaries around what we can know and what we can't know. One of the things that's interesting, perhaps a bit frustrating for Americans surrounding this NSA story, is there's this question of whether or not the Obama administration is getting all this information and whether or not the Obama administration has anything to do with it, or whether or not there's essentially a separate agency within the government that's just doing things external to anything that we can vote for or control ourselves.
Yeah, although I think we know the answer to that question. I think we know that the Obama administration is complicit in this. And when James Clapper came in and lied to Congress, I mean, just absolutely bald-faced lied to Congress. I mean, the right thing to do would have been to, A, fire him, possibly persecute him, or prosecute him for perjury. I mean, there were things that you could do. I mean, there wasn't a whisper out of the Obama administration. He does work for them. So I think we do know the answer to that, that as Bill has suggested, the Obama administration is complicit in this attitude.
Complicit in this attitude, but seemingly protected in a way from this in the public view. It's not exactly the same thing that's happening at the state level, I suppose. Maybe you have some thoughts on that, Bill. But
well, first of all, there's a thing, you know, there's such a thing as willful ignorance.
Yes.
And the fact that the president may or may not arrange to be informed of these things doesn't if he arranges not to be informed, that doesn't make him a better president. But I just want to underscore what Colin said, and it goes to the heart of whether you have a democracy or not. And the more that's done in secret, the less of a democracy you have. And we are really reaching a kind of a critical point here. As with so many of these issues, public opinion couldn't be any clearer. And I would also point out on the privacy issue side of the Snowden stuff that for those of people who espouse original intent of the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment couldn't be any clearer. You know, it says people shall, you know, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation of the person seeking it. None of that's happening now. Just none of it's happening. Zero. Zippo. And so when you look at Clapper walking in, you know, on the one hand, Snowden's holed up wherever he is right now, and Clapper doesn't even have a letter in his file. Mm-hmm. There's not even a slight public scolding. And whatever happens to Snowden, as a citizen of the United States, I have a right to this information so that I can make an informed decision as an elector about the future of this country to the best of my ability. That's what we're all owed, and we're not getting it.
We're going through the big stories of 2013 here on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Bill Curry joins us along with Christine Stewart and Colin McEnroe. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. Turning to Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University. So, first of all, what's your big story of the year? What do you think?
Well, Bill talked a lot about what's done in private, and I think the big story is the government shutdown in October. Because it revealed, even when these things are done in public, just how much the American people are shut out of the process. And so the shutdown to me was major because we take away two lessons. One, I think that Schoolhouse Rock's How a Bill Becomes a Law needs to be required viewing for every member of Congress, right? Before you can run for office, you need to watch that. Because when you have a member of the U.S. House saying, there are four branches of government, and students in my Intro to American Politics class said, but no, wait, there's three. But it says a lot about that level of ignorance. And the fact that so many Americans realize just how vulnerable we all are to the whims of our government. And I think that's a bipartisan failure. It's one of the few things that the American people seem to agree on this year, that the people that we send to represent us are not representing us, they're representing themselves.
Well, what do you take away from this end of the year kind of detente here, and we end up with a budget deal? We actually have Republicans and Democrats, at least in the House, working together to try to solve a small problem, which is let's not have the government shut down again.
Right. So in my own cynical view, I think it's less about let's protect the American people and more about let's protect ourselves in the election next year. So that when you have every member of the U.S. House going up for reelection, people are thinking about that. The Democrats are scared. The president's numbers are down. What will this mean for the party moving forward in 2014 and then later to 2016? And so that shutdown means that members of Congress, the president, are concerned about their political future.
Before we take a break, I just want to give you my big story of the year, and it has to do with Obamacare. It has to do with the Affordable Care Act and how it plays into what Kalila was just talking about. The fact is, Colin, that it seemed as though there was a time this year at which Republicans had run themselves into a ditch, shut down the government, and they were going to pay a heavy political price. And almost immediately, the Obama administration rolled out one of the most disastrous product launches of all time, and it essentially leveled the political playing field.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case. And so the enormous price that the Republican Party would have paid for the shutdown is dropped down to almost nothing, I would think, as a result of that. And, you know, and I hesitate to say this, but I'm looking forward to Bill's analysis of Obamacare. I mean, it's dangerous to yield my time to him, is what I'm really saying. But you know, Bill early on identified some problems. He didn't know all the computer problems they were going to have. But there's two sets of problems with Obamacare. One of them is the rollout, the computers, the ability to log onto the system. The other is the structural problem, whether it actually, once you get on, once everybody gets signed up, does it work or not? That's the part where I'm going to yield my time to Bill. I don't know if we're going to do it in this segment or not, but Bill, I think we'll have some really interesting things to say. You kind of saw this coming too.
Well, and before we actually yield time to Bill, because I do want to talk about this. Christine, one thing that we do take away from this is if you look over the course of the last few months and you look at the various states and how they've done on this Obamacare rollout, it seems as though Connecticut's actually done pretty well for itself.
Connecticut has done pretty well. Apparently, we weren't doing very well in the beginning, though, and they just didn't mention that. So as it was going to launch, some of the information that was hard-coded into the website was wrong. And even though they were asked questions about that, they said that everything's fine, everything is accurate, and it wasn't. So 2,400 people had to go back and look and make sure that they purchased the correct insurance.
Well, and that all said, I think that what the folks who are running the healthcare exchange for Connecticut would say is, you know, look at the numbers. A couple months in here, basically Vermont has a whole bunch of people registered.
We're at about 42,000 now.
We're at about 42,000. There's states like Oregon that have been working on this for years, trying to ramp up for this with little jingles and trying to get people signed up. They essentially have done nothing whatsoever. I mean, what has Connecticut done right? From what you've seen,
you know, Connecticut does have a website that works. It has
okay, check.
Yeah, a small little thing, but you know,
brief round of applause.
as we approach the December deadline, though, there are some issues with getting access to the call center and longer wait times. But you know, there are only three plans at the moment. So there are some advocates who would say that there needs to be a little bit more competition.
I think we need to mention they went to the Lil Wayne concert to tell people
that's
about
right.
It.
That's right. That's right. Jeff Cohen was there, and it was
if we're talking about things they did right.
That was something that they definitely did
you know,
right.
You have a
outreach.
Gift for pulling things together that I've never seen really in anyone
it's
else.
Outreach.
So
you
know, go ahead, Bill.
Well, let me just say, having spent the better part of Monday – signing up. It was my fourth day on the Connecticut website, and it took me 5.5 hours, phone calls, et cetera. And I did finally around – I began at noon, and around 5:30 I did actually succeed. And then at the end of it, at the end of the process, a note comes on the screen and says, someone will call you to confirm this and tell you how to pay for it. I thought, well, you know, Amazon doesn't work that way. I don't wait for someone to call me from Google with the answer to my question.
The drone just comes
just,
and brings it to you.
I was just shocked by that. But to go back to Christine's point, I get that we've done a little better on the signups, but on a national level, and even here we're behind, at a national level we're grossly behind. They've signed up 1.2 million people in the first 2.5 months. Over 800,000 of those are Medicaid signups. And we don't have, because the administration, again, only releases information it wants to release. We don't really know who the other people are. But suffice to say, I think a great many of them are heavily subsidized. The problem with Obamacare is that it doesn't deal with the fundamental issue in American health care, which is cost. And it doesn't do that for the same reason that everything else in government is broken, in large part because our political impasse right now is two parties that are equally committed to the interests of big business. Obama raised more from Wall Street than any candidate, Democrat or Republican, in American history. A left which has died, it's just the patient lay etherized upon the table, and an extreme right which is in absolute, you know, ascendancy still within its party. And so when you take these factors together, no left, deranged right, a tremendous commitment to big business, you get a bailout that doesn't help the homeowners. You get no public option on health care. You get no minimum wage. They're frozen on all the things they need to do to fix what's wrong. And health care should be the jobs bill. Health care should be the fix to the economy. But you only make it that by bringing the cost down. And that means having the courage to take some of the money away from the insurers and put it back into the pockets of the premium payers.
Before we break, Kalila, you said you're cynical about the way the government is working or not working this past year. Are you less cynical about, you know, perhaps Obamacare beginning to work, about more signups, about the costs maybe coming under control?
More signups are great, but people need to know for what they're signing up, right? And the amount of intellectual capital that it takes to not only navigate the process, but to understand what is this going to mean to your monthly bottom line. I think that's where the administration has failed. I think that's where organizations have failed. And to get back to this question, you can't cut SNAP benefits on the one hand and then say we're now going to open up health care and that will equal everything out. What's the tax? on social service agencies who deal with this on an everyday level who say we are overwhelmed.
We're talking with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Bill Curry, our political analyst, Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We're going to get to some of your thoughts on what the news story of the year is. Both John and Gideon's Trumpet tweeted at us. They say the NSA and the Snowden story are their stories of the year. What do you think? You can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, and it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, our final wheelhouse of the year. So we're looking back at 2013, looking ahead at 2014. We want to hear from you. What are your big news stories of this past year? What do you want to see happen in 2014? Call us at 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at Where We Live or continue the conversation online at WNPR.org. Let's go to David in Woodbury first. Hey, David, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hello, everybody. Goodness, in the 1950s, I remember when I was young, Connecticut had the safest driving record in the whole country, and it was because the then Governor Ribicoff lowered the speed limit, at least on the Barrett and Wilbur Cross Parkway, by 5 miles an hour, and I would like to see the same happened on well, certainly 84 and wherever it would be practical.
So you want to see slower speed limits, people slowing down on the highways and maybe a little bit safer roads. First of all, David, I'll say thank you for your phone call. Some interesting things out of that very quickly. Tucker Ives ran some numbers for us, Colin. We put them up online a couple weeks ago. We've had a few of the safest holiday driving seasons ever here in Connecticut for some reason over the course of the last year. Another thing I really want to get to is we need to talk about something that might come up in the legislature this year is tolls, actually slowing down traffic on the highways because we're going to try to, you know, tax people.
Yeah, I personally think tolls is a non-starter, and I also think it's a bad idea. I think tolls actually. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to make driving safer, and we found a lot of those ways, and there's some other ways. And David will be glad to know the speed limit on I-84 today is about 22 miles an hour.
22 miles an hour.
But you know, I think tolls are bad in a lot of ways. I think they can be made a lot better. And obviously, when we say tolls, we imagine the tolls that we used to have. As opposed to, I mean, every toll system now is basically Easy Pass or something like it. My guess is it's just politically not a workable thing, and I don't even think it's a great idea.
What do you think, Christine? Is it going to happen?
If they would just stop raiding the Special Transportation Fund for the general fund, they took $91 million out of it this year. So that's taking money away from transportation, highway improvements, improving the road, and putting it towards just basically everything else.
When you say raiding the transportation fund, explain more, because when I talk to the governor about this, he says, we don't raid the transportation fund.
Well, that's
he's kidding.
Not true.
Yeah.
He's pulling my leg.
Yeah, he's kidding you. Yeah,
No, they did that. In 2005, they set a schedule for increasing the gas tax. So they've increased the gas tax steadily over the past few years, and then they've taken some of that money and just thrown it into the general fund.
You know, one of the things that Colin raised earlier was the idea of Keno coming in at the 11th hour, something that didn't have any sort of public comment period. And now supposedly it's law in Connecticut, although we don't see Keno parlors everywhere. Kalila, one of the things I thought that was a big story of 2013 is this idea about gambling as a revenue source. To our north, Massachusetts is trying to site a series of casinos. The governor there, Deval Patrick, thought this would be a good idea to compete with the big Connecticut casinos in the southeastern part of the state. Of course, they started this process just at the time at which people started spending a little less money at casinos. Mm-hmm. And now, as they go from town to town, the towns in Massachusetts don't seem to like it. Do you think that this is going to be a year where we start to rethink whether or not gambling, whether it's Keno in our, you know, restaurants and bars, or whether or not it's big casinos in Massachusetts or Connecticut, Why don't we rethink that as a way to raise money for the government?
I think it's a time for that to happen, and I think it will happen, because I think governments are starting to realize it's really a short-sighted solution, that all of the problems that come along with gambling, whether it's being able to sustain those industries, you see the down revenues in Connecticut, whether it's the problems of addiction, and just the public pushback against that. I think you're seeing that in New York. In Maryland, Connecticut, Massachusetts, the public is really not supportive the way that they were, say, 10 years ago.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Johnny tweets at us, we should make an express lane from New York to Rhode Island and charge a big toll. You don't have to deal.
I like that idea.
You don't have to deal with local traffic. Big money for the state. That's Johnny's idea. You can keep your ideas coming. Tweet them at Where We Live. We wanted to actually talk a little bit about state politics in this segment, Christine. And let's actually listen to a little bit of one of our favorite television ads, or at least online ads around here that we've seen this year.
But wait a second. Connecticut next year will probably elect a new governor. When it does, Connecticut once again will be the place people want to be in the Northeast.
Yes, that's Tom Foley in a political ad that ran in New York City.
Salute the man for his confidence.
Earlier this year. Just let's talk this through again. It's been a while since that went on. This is Tom Foley essentially seemingly appealing to people in New York. Maybe it'll be time to go to Connecticut once he's governor. It was a weird thing.
Yeah, to move back to Connecticut after he becomes governor. I'm not quite sure as to what exactly. That was just a very confusing ad for me.
It was a very confusing ad. It was part of a confusing little political start for Tom Foley this year. He puts out this ad bill, and he comes on our show and goes on Dennis House's show on WFSB mm-hmm. and starts to make a series of allegations about the Moy administration. Then when some of them stick and some of them don't, he says, well, I don't have to be right about all these things. Off to a kind of a rocky start for a Foley campaign, it seems.
It seems to me that he's two or three times now squandered an issue that not only here but really across the country. The question of the ethics of government, the openness of government, the efficiency of government, the professionalism of it has never been more important to the American people. Scott Rasmussen, a conservative pollster, did alternative exit polls in two straight elections in the teeth of a recession, finding that ethics outstripped jobs and the economy in a recession as the first reason people gave for on which they based their vote. And because political consultants and the political office holders have no interest in discussing this, and because they're so good at tamping it down, we don't see it in the debate among the elites. But the public feels strongly about this. To then walk in, however, and just start shooting everybody in the saloon as opposed to just the bank robbers, you know, to just start, strafing takes that and it makes actually – however legitimate the issue may or may not be, you turn the target of your ire into a victim in the eyes of some. And so it's going to be – it's harder for him now to make this case. As Colin said, as I think we all agree here, these issues of openness and integrity in government are big. But I'm not sure this is the person – this person who thinks that – we still don't know whether Roland did anything wrong, Tom Foley – I'm not sure he's the right messenger to bring this. He sure has been so far.
Well, there's also this year they passed campaign finance reform laws that basically kind of eliminate, in my view, the publicly financed campaign system where they allow parties to give unlimited amounts of money to publicly financed candidates, kind of dismantling the system in a way.
Yeah, and this is another one of the things we looked at, Colin. It just sort of happened along the way this year, and we looked back and said, huh, I thought we were going to be the state that had the tough campaign finance laws.
Yeah, maybe I won't name his name, but in the middle of all this, in one of these late nights at the Capitol, one of the governor's staff came up to me and started talking to me about this law and saying, I think you're going to like what we did with it. And he had some kind of explanation for why I was going to like what they'd done to the campaign finance law. And when I looked at it, it was just this horrific monstrosity of a law. And I think it means that one of the stories of the campaign, of the 2014 campaign, will be, where's the money coming coming from. We're going to be playing whack-a-mole here. You know, we're going to be trying to figure out where's the money coming from. As Christine said, the parties can raise more money and they can spend it differently. There are going to be a lot of third-party expenditures on behalf of Governor Malloy, who was able to sort of run the first time around as this kind of pure publicly financed candidate. I don't think that's going to be the case this time, and I think we're going to spend a lot of time looking at that. Just quickly back to the issue of Foley, too. I think one thing we need to say here is, I mean, the Malloy people, they look at Foley and they're Sylvester and he's Tweety Bird. You know, they can't wait to run against Tom Foley. I think they're much more nervous about some of the other candidates. But I think if they get to pick, they'll pick Foley. But I'm not sure it's going to be that easy for them.
I guess I wonder quickly, Christine, on this, when we might start to get some clarity. I mean, next year, as we look forward, is a gubernatorial election year. Sometimes we would have been a little deeper into that campaign already than we seem to be right now. Mm-hmm. When will we start to get a little bit more clarity about what's happening on the Republican side of the ticket?
We're going to begin to have a sense probably as soon as January. People are going to decide whether they're, you know, they're in this or not for governor, and then May is when the conventions are, so the will choose.
And then who will the nominee be, Christine?
Who will the nominee be?
Yeah.
I'm not a betting gal.
Yeah. Kalila, any thoughts about this? Because obviously this is going to be a big election year, but we, as Colin just said, we see Tom Foley as a kind of front runner just because he, you know, he ran very closely with Governor Malloy last time around. What do you see coming out of this?
Well, I think it raises the question not just where is the money coming from, but also how it's being spent. So Foley could have used that money instead of buying this sort of ridiculous ad in New York to hire a campaign staff who could actually say, no, wait, that's not what you want to do. And I think that as you have more and more candidates who are independently wealthy, who have a lot of money to sort of play around, we're going to be inundated with ridiculous ads, a lot of these outreach efforts that may not address the fundamental question, which is, what are the issues facing the state and who can best navigate them? Having us taken away from that by these kinds of ads does nothing to advance the state.
Bill?
You know, I just one thing I've said on these shows many times is that policy precedes message, and that many people in politics on both sides now don't understand. First, you figure out what you believe, and then how to tell people about it. And there's no greater example of how that works than the candidacies of Linda McMahon and Foley, who come back a second time. Foley's doing just what McMahon did, to come back a second time, and I listen to these things, and you realize he hasn't studied any issues. He hasn't taken that. He hasn't bothered to turn himself into a knowledgeable candidate on Connecticut issues, and there's a kind of casual way of these are just sort of tossed aside. Oh, I might have had that right. I might not have. And I think that that'll be a tremendous advantage if John McKinney. You know, if there are other people who are potential candidates on their side who I think would be much stronger candidates. I agree that Foley's the least. But it is that taking all that money, spending it on all these ads, and not bothering to really learn the nature of the tax structure, the historic problems, et cetera, the things a governor really has to engage and maybe even one of those two problems actually fix.
We're going to take some of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 as we look at the big stories of the year. Miles tweets at us. He says the stories of the year are the efforts to raise the minimum wage, or the shootings and reports of shootings in Colorado, at Yale, at Harvard. And, of course, we can lump in with those, Colin, all of the things that have happened at the various Connecticut campuses this year and the Boston Marathon bombings. It seems as though to me, and obviously to our listener, one of the big stories is this sense of being on edge. We talked about this a lot on Saturday when we did our special broadcast on the one-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook shootings. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, because that seems to be one of the big changes in America right now. This idea of shelter in place is something that we now understand to be a regular thing.
Yeah, that was your line on Saturday, that you never heard the phrase shelter in place a year ago. And I think that is, you know, America as kind of lockdown nation is one of the big changes. And in some ways, obviously, we look at that and we think, and Dahlia Lithwick had a great piece about this in Slate. You know, what are we doing to kids, you know, if we're constantly locking down their schools and sending them this message that they are in danger? On the other hand, I keep coming back to University of New Haven, where I think there's a – I mean, I don't want to put this guy on trial right now. He'll get that. But I think there's a good chance that that lockdown nation attitude, that heightened sense of vigilance, may have averted a potential disaster at the University of New Haven. So, yeah, a lot of these things have been false alarms. But, you know, there's a ratio here. And I think the ratio, when you look at something like the New Haven incident, you think, well, maybe that ratio is acceptable.
Christine, this upcoming legislative session, do we expect to see more around school security? There was some after Sandy Hook in the last legislative session. Is this going to be something that's on people's minds once again?
School security, I mean, they have bonded $24 million for that. What's interesting is that at the Capitol complex itself, well, we don't have metal detectors. There is only one door that is open to the state capitol, and now we have signs that make sure that people know that you can't bring your firearm inside of the state capitol. So things have changed in that sense, too.
But they did have metal detectors at certain points around certain very controversial hearings.
Yes. During the public hearing on the gun bills, they did have metal detectors. And they do have metal detectors there, and they've had them there. They just don't use them. But, I mean, the Texas State Capitol also has metal detectors. But if you have a lobbyist badge, then you can bring your concealed firearm with you into the Capitol building.
What?
And into the
really?
Classroom
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I didn't realize that lobbyists can carry firearms to Texas.
Yes.
Okay. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're going to take a break. We got a few phone calls we want to get to. We'll come back. We'll get some of the predictions maybe for 2014, talk through some of the other big issues of 2013. We're joined by Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Bill Curry, our political analyst, and Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to Connecticut's healthcare advocate about a new initiative to improve the quality of healthcare while reducing costs. We'll find out more about the state innovation model and what it means for doctors and what it means for patients. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We've got an all-star panel here. The cameras of CTN are here trying to capture this panel in its full glory. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Let's go to the phones here. John's in West Hartford. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, John. John Holder from WWH.
Hey, John.
Quick question for Bill. Before the last break, Bill mentioned the fact that the left is dead. I'm hoping you can give a postmortem as to how and why you think that is.
Thank you, John,
how much
so
time
much.
You got?
It's too long a question to do justice, but I think a number of things happened. But, you know, first of all, there's beginning in the early 1970s to today, there's been a 40-year period in which the parties have changed identities to an enormous degree. And the decline of the left, it began when I found a wonderful story, but when George McGovern lost by so much to Richard Nixon, Bob Strauss, a businessman lobbyist, was taken in to run the Democratic Party. And the first thing he did was destroy the McGovern mailing lists so the Democrats wouldn't be doing issue fundraising. It took us 30 years to even begin to develop after that a grassroots issue base. Labor declined for 100 reasons, forces in the world and choices here. The left, which had been nonpartisan, became very much a creature of the Democratic Party. When movements became institutions in Washington, they became lobbyists. They began to see the world through their subcommittee chairs' eyes. They began to be assimilated and bureaucratized. The grassroots have died. If you look at – I'll just summarize by saying if you look at the history of this country, whether it's populism in the late 19th century, the progressives at the turn of the 20th, the labor movement into the 30s, and the extraordinarily effective movements of the 1960s, women, environment, and so forth, they were all nonpartisan. They weren't they didn't carry water for either political party. They were truly grassroots with real interaction, person to person, face to face. They weren't just mimicking the message politics of the parties. And they had a discrete and concrete and understandable agendas that were simple and that spoke to the entire public, not just niche marketing. All of that is gone. This is the longest we've gone without a grassroots progressive movement in this history in 150 years. And we have to look at the reasons for that.
I don't think that we should overlook the type of grassroots organizing that is occurring in this country. It's changed. It's not the sort of institutional movement building. But if you look at the reaction to the George Zimmerman verdict this year, and that it mobilized people in a way who feel overlooked and shut out of traditional politics. So even though a lot of that organizing is happening in social media or happening in conversations amongst young people, it does lay the foundation for what do you do next. And people were very critical. Democrats weren't speaking out on behalf of Trayvon Martin's family. It wasn't that they felt co-opted by the party. It was, what do we do so that we move from a moment to a movement? And I think those conversations are happening.
To a degree, but it goes back to any one of these questions. Our inability in the land of the lotus eaters to sustain a conversation, and I'm not asking for institutions. The institutions haven't worked really well, but I don't see that the great promise of the blogosphere and the internet to be an organizing tool for progressive politics. We have enough evidence. It's not true. It's absolutely not true, and people who want to change this country have to begin to think of a new model.
I just have to say that this morning on CNN, when I walked into the newsroom, I was watching a very interesting segment about an art critic taking a look at George Zimmerman's artistic work, which is, I guess, going for some $100,000 on eBay right now. So that's where the conversation on the national media, at least, has moved vis-a-vis Trayvon Martin, it seems. Patrick from Franklin's on the line. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just listening on the radio, and I heard the folks talking about the metal detectors that were set up in Hartford and some safety in regards to safety concerns. And I just had a quick comment in regards to that, that last year when the legislative bodies were debating the bill for this current gun law, they had the mental health committees. They had the committee set up for people speaking about gun control or gun rights. And I found it ironic that they only set up metal detectors for when the folks who were coming to speak either for or against guns showed up. And I isn't that kind of discrimination or profiling a certain group of people? I find it troubling that if there is, maybe they were having a committee hearing on race relations or something like that, and they set up metal detectors when they never have set up metal detectors, it raises concerns why they didn't set up metal detectors for all the other public hearings.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much. And it's something that we were sort of getting at, but you asked the question pointedly, Christine.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, they set up metal detectors for one public hearing on one day, and the issue that day was guns. And, you know, there were 2,000 people in the building, and that's what the Capitol Police decided to do.
Although Christine is a member of the press who had to cover that hearing, if they'd given you a choice, metal detectors today or no metal detectors with the gun people coming in, which would you pick?
Well, you know, the gun people did come in for the day to the actual Capitol for the day of the vote. So I don't believe, I mean, I think it was clear that you can't bring your firearm into the building. So.
Okay, as a member of the press, I'll go with Patrick here on this one. I'll say metal detectors every day. That's the new, it's just like everything else.
Fine,
this is the new world. We'll have metal detectors everywhere. No one can bring their guns. There's a big sign. And
I really believe in the equal protection of the law. When you have a movement, one of whose points is that you ought to be able to take guns into the Capitol, and which is so deeply estranged, so many people within it. This isn't the gun, the NRA that I knew when I was coming up. This isn't an NRA of sportsmen and fishermen. This is one of gun manufacturers and fantasists, of people who actually prepare for war with their government. To say that having a metal detector, which no matter which side of the question you were on that day, you had to go through, no matter what your role was, you had to go through, to say that you can't pick an issue that might draw a crowd that would be a little harder to handle, I think that would be a mistake.
Maybe just you put them up and they're just there every day. The state already owns them. We'll move on here. There's a lot of people who want to get on board. A lot of tweets today. Alyssa's story of the year is Pope Francis. Jan says the government shutdown hurt me big time. Josh says the president finally getting serious about climate change. Wait, no. Promises, promises. And Stephen tweets, I'm really hoping for Martha Dean. Hilarity ensues. I know there's a few different things. Things we want to get to in there. Maybe we can pick up on those in the last few minutes we have, Colin. One thing that I absolutely want to make sure we got to, we've talked an awful lot on the air about, it seemed like in many ways a kind of a bad year for UConn. We ended up with this rebranding of the university as UConn, not the University of Connecticut, with this brand new Husky logo. There are concerns about whether or not it's become too much of a jock culture. It's as it becomes too much of a jock culture, the football team completely falls on its face and they fire the football coach. Meanwhile, there are allegations of sexual abuse on campus and more allegations about the way the university has responded. It just seems like for our flagship university, in a lot of ways, kind of a tough year.
Well, mega dittos, as they say on the Rush Limbaugh show. I mean, yeah, I second all your emotions, and I do think that Susan Herbst, the president of UConn, had a really, really horrible year. And one of the real questions is, can she turn UConn around in all of the ways that you talked about? Can she seem less like, once again, to use sort of to go back to Bill's language, an instrument of big business and more like a humanist? And I think, you know, it really does kind of go to her right now, what kind of leadership she's going to show around these issues. I mean, she can't fix the football program all by herself. She can't run back punts, stuff like that. But there's a lot of things that she can do. And if there's, you know, if you had to make a list of five people in Connecticut you're going to watch with a lot of interest in the coming year, there'd be no way for her not to be on it.
But beyond just the University of Connecticut and all this, Kalila, you work on a college campus. The idea of sexual assault on college campuses is something that was highlighted by this lawsuit and this complaint by these UConn students, current and former. This is something that I think a lot of schools, not just the University of Connecticut, have had to start to think about in a new way. Maybe 2014 is a year in which more schools get better policies and get more serious about this.
I hope that 2014 is a year where we start addressing these issues on college campuses, whether it's school safety, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's binge drinking. Being on a campus every day, I see students when they're at their most vulnerable. And I think if we don't have those measures in place, this will happen again. And for a university president, the duty is first and foremost to protect your students and to ask those difficult questions and make sure you're following through so that when a group of students come and say they feel harassed or they feel unprotected, you have to take that seriously.
I know that we just have a couple minutes left. A few quick things I want to get to. One is, Christine, you wrote a column just this last week looking ahead at 2014. What are some things that you think the legislature is going to be involved in this upcoming legislative session?
The upcoming legislative session, they're going to go back to assisted suicide for people who are terminally ill. That's going to be an issue. Some of the task forces that they've been working on involving mental health and, you know, improving our mental health issues and access to services for people. And then, you know, transportation, always a perennial issue, the tolling issue. I'm trying to think of something else.
Well, you say transportation, a perennial issue. We spent an awful lot of time this year talking about Metro North.
Yes.
Are we going to have a big statewide push to try to fix this rail system, which seemingly has had, again, a really bad 2013?
This is a really interesting bipartisan issue. So they agree on this, and they believe that, you know, those alert systems should be implemented in the trains.
Well, what are some predictions you have for 2014, Colin? What are some things you're looking at this year?
Well, one of the tweeters brought this up. I think we will see the return of Martha Dean. She showed every sign of doing it. And it kind of raises a big question about the functionality of the Republican Party. I mean, is she going to be the candidate for attorney general? Obviously, she's a pretty polarizing candidate. She goes as far to the right as you can possibly go. Can they get their act together and find somebody else to run in that spot? Can they find somebody good, somebody interesting to run in the 5th District against Elizabeth Esty, who would be the most imperiled congressperson this year? My other quick prediction is, and because I've kind of gone back and forth on this a couple of times already, I do believe in the case of Eddie Perez that failing some kind of successful appeal of the appellate court's decision, that the state will attempt to, rather than work out a plea with him, they will seek two new trials in his case.
And do you have any sort of thought about what those new trials will hold?
Well, I mean, I think the reason they're going to do that is because the appellate court basically said, yeah, you know what? You won. You won both those cases. The judge let you combine them, and that's a problem. But individually, I mean, they didn't use this exact language, but they basically said, you won. You know, you got them. You just didn't do it the right way.
Kalila, you have 30 seconds here. What's a big prediction? What's something you maybe want to see in 2014?
Well, big issue, Tony Harp will become the mayor of New Haven, which opens up her seat in the state Senate. So really looking forward to see who will not only fill out that term or fill that seat, but what impact it may have on the legislature as a whole, particularly when it comes to appropriations.
And maybe a new leadership style in New Haven. This is going to be a very interesting year
for
the Elm City. And Bill, we just have about 30 seconds here. What's something you're looking for?
On the political front, I'm not terribly optimistic. I think that this recent negotiated $85 billion budget deal in the Congress was really an agreement not to do anything for 2 years. The only way that gets better is in the hands of John Boehner. If he happens to change the rules in the House, you might get some very Republican-oriented but nonetheless somewhat immigration. Two or three things might move forward a little bit. In order to end this on a positive note in this Christmas season, Pope Francis is now beyond a doubt the most powerful spiritual leader in the world. and his impact on all public discussion. It's not ideological or political. It is to get us to approach these things first in moral language and in moral categories of thought. And I think that's just a boon to us all, and it will pay off big in the long term.
Birthday boy Bill Curry is our political analyst. 35 looks great on you, Bill.
The Pope and I. Yeah, actually. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Colin pointed out.
Kalilah Brown Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Christine Stewart, who is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Good to see you, Christine.
Thank you.
And Colin McEnroe, we'll hear you on the radio at 1 o'clock today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live.